Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Larry Schultz, 42 years of combination experience, Assistant Chief with Anne Arundel Fire Department in Maryland, retired Assistant Chief of Operations with DC Fire Department, and retired Assistant Chief of Operations with Alexandria Fire Department. One thing you might have caught on to, Larry can't truly remain retired. He loves the fire service, but makes clear in the interview that the job owes him nothing. Everything he has is because of the job that some may take for granted. When Larry decided to join the fire service back in the 80s, it was a very demanding profession to get into, as he had to go up against thousands to get hired. Once he was able to get on, he made sure to listen to the senior men above him, keep his head down, and grind it out. Whether that was keeping his nose in the books, cleaning, or doing his job as a firefighter, that's exactly what he did, and after a few years on the job, started to move himself up the ranks. Larry spoke the truth in this interview, and I truly hope you all can pick up some of the things Larry was putting down. With that, I present Larry Schultz.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Larry Schultz. I am an incredibly blessed husband to my wife, Joanne. I have three adult children, three grandchildren, and we all live out here in Maryland, towards the Annapolis area. So got the whole family close to home here. Been in the fire service for 42 years now. I started in the early 1980s, really difficult time to try to get hired because there were not a lot of career opportunities in the fire service. And there were literally thousands of people applying for any time a job came up for that. So I went a different route and I took a job with the military as a federal firefighter. It was a little bit of a more streamlined process, and got hired out here locally at an Army base in Maryland. Very cool. I was 20 years old. I think I made about $7 an hour, and it was 24 on, 24 off, and that was it, right, in perpetuity. Every couple months, you got a 3 or 4 day break. But I was wearing a uniform, and I couldn't have been more happy with that. I never had a bad day there. The number of hours, none of that mattered. I wanted to get in the fire department, and that was the first opportunity I got. So I started working with a great couple crews there. And just about 2 years after, in that 1984, 85 timeframe, I got a call from the Washington, D.C. Fire Department. That had been my dream job. I live right outside the Washington, D.C. area and grew up looking at that system, and that was it for me. I wanted to be part of that organization, and got a phone call to get hired in D.C. and did that. Went to recruit school, was 10 weeks at the time, so super easy, in and out and out in the field, and I had an amazing career in that department. I spent 26 years there, rose through the ranks, the higher ranks, in a very unpredictable way, not the normal pathway, but that is a department that that never disappointed me at any point in time in my career. I loved every single day I was there. The people that worked with, I was on the retired firefighters website this morning for DCFD, just looking at people and the things that they're doing, and just remembering stories and time spent with a career. But again, talk about a blessing. I walked out of there that, job owed me nothing. I gained far more from it than I ever gave. And it'll always be at the core of my heart. Left there and did a couple unique things. Wasn't sure what I wanted to do after retirement there. So I had a background in emergency management and did a little bit of that. took an interesting job as a coordinator for four volunteer fire departments that were merging into a municipal fire department. And then life happens in the midst of that. My son was diagnosed with cancer, and it was important to me to come back home. I was living out of state at the time, so came back home. He did fine and all that, and then went back to work in the fire department. Got an opportunity to go to work for a very cool little city, Alexandria, Virginia, which is just on the other side of the Potomac River from Washington, D.C. It looked so much like Washington, D.C. Anyway, so went there, spent just under 5 years there as the assistant chief of operations. Another great, great place. It was my first real experience at a small department. In DC, I had about 25, 2600 people. City of Alexandria was about 300. So whole new learning experience for me there. And managing people and issues in a department that just because of the smallness and the closeness, I didn't have a lot of experience dealing with in DC. And so I learned a lot there, worked with some amazing, amazing people. Again, when I left that job, they owed me nothing. I again benefited. I received more from them than they got from me. But a great place. And then, in an unusual turn of events, I had been mentoring a young lady who was a lieutenant in this department here. She wanted to have a bigger career in the fire department, and just looking career-wise in the 20, 25 years she would be here, and what her opportunities were would be to become a fire chief, would probably take every bit of that time for her to compete internally. So she took a different pathway, and I did some mentoring for her in the realm of leadership and just kind of overall fire department management stuff, philosophy, practices. She was very, very intelligent, very gifted. It was easy to tell she was going to be very successful at what she did. And she got her a first opportunity for her was a number two position out in the Midwest, and she took it. Wasn't necessarily where she planned on being, but knew that that would provide her a pathway. Was there for a couple of years, got another opportunity out west. Kind of an elevated position, right? Kind of climbing that ladder. And lo and behold, there was an election in the county where I work now, and where she worked prior to leaving. And she got the opportunity to come back and be the fire chief. And it just so happens this is the jurisdiction that I live in and have lived in for the past 20 bunch of years. And she called me and gave me an opportunity to come work for her, which was a turn of event, right? And so I've been here 7 years now, and that's kind of the story to see this point. There's a see what's next in the journey after this.
Okay. All right. I'm going to go back a little bit, back to DC. The dream department, you get the call, you get on, you get the recruit class. What was your first assignment, and what did it feel like walking through the doors of a DC firehouse?
Yeah, it's a great question. I went to school, had a great group of people that I came through the academy with. Most people didn't have any experience, and the experience that I bought from both my volunteer and the military department was minimal. It was nothing. There was no comparison to that. But having gone through the state fire school and all that stuff, at least you could muck your way through the train academy pretty quickly. I had a hook for my first assignment. It was a childhood best friend who was at what was called the Big House in Washington, D.C. It was the only station in the city with an engine, a truck, a rescue, and a battalion chief. So there were about 20 people on the floor every day, more than that, probably. Yeah, definitely more than that, but around that number. And that was my first assignment. It was a amazing place. I was very, very young. The department was reasonably older at that time. There was still that Large group of people who had come from the Vietnam era time frame. And again, I had there were plenty of documentaries. I buffed DC, so I had a good idea of how the department operate. But I went in, and my probation year was very simple. And I know that things have changed. That's a fact. Whether I agree with all the changes or not that happened in the fire service along the time is a different story. But in that time, when you were a recruit, it was truly, don't speak unless you're spoken to or unless you have questions. How do I do this? How do I use this tool? Those anything that was training and informative, you could ask away. But other than that, you spent your 24-hour shift at the watch desk, they sit watch there in DC today. A watchman's at the watch desk all the time. So in the recruit year, that is where you lived, except for the time to go to bed and the time to eat. When you got done dinner, you wash the dishes, then you're back at the watch desk, and it's study, study, study. The only time you should be out from the watch desk is either if you were on a run or if you're working on the rigs, right? So cleaning tools, cleaning rigs, those type of things. And I never went a day where there weren't three, four, five, six senior people who would come in and spend an hour with me at the desk, see if I needed help with my book, just keep my mind straight, give me their little tidbits along the way. And that year was foundational for everything else in my career. And I think that there's a reason that those things existed, right? Make the coffee, put up the flag, those things that at some point in time have been termed unnecessary or just, tradition. But it gave me such a foundation and a focus for what would then go on to be the rest of my career. So I was welcome when in with wide open arms on day one. The expectations were very clear. You're going to have time to play volleyball. You're going to have time to yuck it up at the coffee table. You're going to have time to come to weddings. You're going to have time to do all that stuff. Now is not the time. For this period of time, you are going to do this. And it worked well for me. And I had a new kid come in right when I was getting off probation. So I was still the rookie for a long, long time, but was able to move my way out of the watch desk a little bit after that. So just incredible.
Okay. And at what point in your career did you decide to start moving up the ranks and why?
Again, I didn't have, excuse me. I knew that over time I wouldn't want to promote, and really, when I was in that station with the guys that I worked with, every one of those people meant more to me than anything I know. They were foundational in my life and my career. Again, I was relatively young compared to them. And I listened very carefully to what they said, and we had a blast. We went to work. Every shift, it was everything you could imagine. And my crew, that the kind of the smaller group of guys from the engine and truck that I work with, of course you get that piece where you love it and you can't even think about leaving. And there was that pull to say, hey, we got something really good here. Don't go screw it up by taking a promotion exam. That would, kind of be the message from some. All well intended, no, nothing nefarious, all well intended. But for whatever reason, the older we ran a wagon pumper system. So we went out with a two-piece engine company. The pumper drivers were always older guys, and the chauffeurs were mostly older too. And those were the guys who had a different kind of influence, where they would come in and say, look, you love this job. You seem like you have a lot to offer. You need to start preparing now for promotion. Take opportunities. Don't pass them by. So when it came time for me to be eligible to take my first exam at the 5 year mark, it really was there was a pull. Do I stay with these guys that I love? They are my brothers to the core. Or do I progress up the organization because there's other opportunities? And so I did. I took a promotion exam. The first promotion in DC is to sergeant. It's like a covering lieutenant. At that time, you would generally compete with about 600, 700 people for the sergeant's exam. I did well. I got promoted in the first group out. Broke my heart to leave that place, but again, when I tell you that that job benefited me in every way, my assignment, next assignment, and every assignment after that, just over the top, amazing.
Okay. And how long did you wait? Just trying to get a number.
The minimum was 5 years. And
5 years. Okay.
of course, it's timing, right? Because you could be eligible and there not be another test for 2 more years. So
Right.
when I was eligible, there was a test right away, and it lined up for me
Okay.
on
And then I'm assuming after and with DC, do you have to go through each? Are you allowed to skip rank or do you have to
No, you
go?
go through sergeant, lieutenant, captain, battalion chief, deputy chief, assistant chief. Yeah.
Okay. All right. With that being said, when you got to the lieutenant role or captain, let's just say a company officer role, what kind of leader did you want to be and what does leadership look like to you?
A good question again. I had great examples. I know it sounds like I'm hyping this up. I've got no reason to hype it up. The officers that I had worked for in my career were all very different, but all incredible. So I had some good examples early on. So there were a couple things that were important to me. And look, let me start by saying, at the firefighter rank, I was far from the model employee, right? I got way too comfortable too early, and while my officers were good, I had officers who would, if I stepped out of line, would have been right there. And then I had officers who probably gave me more leeway than I deserved, because technically I was good at my job. I showed up to work at 4 o'clock every morning. I had the tools out every morning, sharp and clean. And when it came to the technical aspects of the job, I prided myself in being really, really good, along with the other guys that I worked with. We prided ourselves on that. And along the way, when you have a company like that, officers can either, really kind of keep you in line, or if you catch somebody a little bit older towards the end of their career, they may say, "Hey, these kids know what they're doing. I give them a little bit of leeway." Even as a kid, I was never good with having lots of leeway. I would generally take things to the extreme if I could take them that way. So when I got to the I knew that as a new officer, I wanted a competency. Today, 42 years into my career, when I talk about expectations, there's two things that always are the first and second, and anybody who's worked with me for the last 42 years would tell you this. One is competency. You got to be a competent firefighter. You got to master the skill sets and be able to perform when people call. And the second is to be selfless. Just be a selfless person to your crew, to the community, to whomever. Just live a selfless life. And so I figured, the competency piece, I can teach people that. I know how to hold a company to a standard of competency, but do the work to get everybody there and to not accept anything different. So that was number one. Number two was to take care of each other. And that doesn't mean to cover up for each other, but to take care of each other means to hold each other accountable, to get better every day, hold each other accountable to show up and do the right thing at the incident scene, hold each other accountable to show up and for 24 hours be at the station, not with your issues at home, not with those, with distractions. So competency, hold each other accountable. And then the third was to that I would just say, don't put me in a bad position. I accepted this promotion. I know that it comes with responsibility. I'm going to have to do that. And if you put me in a position of having to hold you accountable, then I'm going to do that. And so it was pretty simple, right? Kind of follow along those three rules. Most of the time I was young. I didn't have formal leadership training. So the main crux of your question would be, I saw what I liked. I saw what I didn't like in officers. I emulated the good things. And even though there were many times where I couldn't get out of my own way, I probably, well, not I probably, I certainly demonstrated behaviors that I'm not proud of.
Okay. No, I totally understand that. Okay. And did you ever in your wildest dreams think that you would make it to Assistant Chief of Operations for the
No,
DC Fire Department?
yeah, no, gosh. So I don't I am I quit school in the ninth grade. That's my last formal year of education in the ninth grade. Took had a GED. School was just not good for me, or I was not good for school is probably the better way to put that. But I could study, and I would study for 8, 9, 10 months, and it would all be memorization for me. Memorize the books. So I could always take the test and do well again, because I did have good self-discipline. And thanks to my wife who raised our family and gave me 7 and 8 months on every day off to go sit in a library or sit in somebody's house and study the books. Without the ability to just focus on memorization and do that. So the goal was to get the battalion chief. I always thought the battalion chief was a pretty cool gig. Honestly, in a very short and brief way, I was highly underqualified. Again, I don't have much of an educational background. I had been relatively young throughout my career at every promotion level. And 9/11 happened. I was a captain at a rescue company following 9/11. And DC, New York, Chicago, LA, following 9/11, got this a bolus of funding for emergency preparedness. Right at 9/11, the fire departments are not prepared to deal with this. We've got to do something about this. DC got a large sum of money, and the fire chief called me up. I was a captain at a rescue. He was a good man. I had never worked for him before. Very strict guy. I had never worked for him before, but he had called me up and say, "Hey, we just started this special operations program." There were some other people running what. We had the special operations. It was informal. It was the rescue squads. And we've got to formalize it. And it's got to get into terrorism and all these other things. And he said, the guy in there now is going to retire. So I want you to go take that over as the battalion chief. There was no test process. It was appointment at that point in time. And I had said, Chief, God bless, but I don't have any background in any, I've been a company officer. I had the budgeting and program management. I got no experience in that. And he said, I was looking through your folder, and you took a class on terrorism awareness, which was true. It was an online class for terrorism awareness. And he said, best I can see, you're qualified. So you're going to do this job. totally surprised by that. But went into the position to then build the Special Operations Homeland Security program. And then from there, I promoted into that as the Deputy Chief of Homeland Security, overseeing all the special events and presidential inaugurations and the technical rescue and hazmat program, the Marine program, all that stuff. Got to build it up to be its own division over about a 5-year period. And that gave me a lot of exposure. Not because of anything I did, but just because the position gave me exposure to elected officials and things like that. And then when it just happened to be a change of administration, I had a conversation with the new mayor. Certainly didn't think that I had the capability to lead the organization. Again, I was maybe 43 years old. I mean, most people in the job were older than I am. And he appointed me to be the assistant chief of operations, and that's how I moved into that position. So younger than anybody who had served in that position before, I didn't take the traditional pathway that others would have took. And so that's how I got into it. Completely unimaginable. You couldn't write it. Certainly wasn't anything that I deserved or did anything spectacular. I happened to have some knowledge in a specific area that at that particular time became the forefront of the fire service, which was terrorism, homeland security, special operations.
Okay. And in your personal opinion, the way the fire service is going, it's trending towards, there's that debate between experience and education. So with your experiences and in your opinion, do you believe education holds more value than experience or like what's your take on that?
So, and that's a great question. I have that discussion with people all the time, and I think I certainly don't want to be a guy who is a crying over spilt milk. I had complete control over what education I did or did not pursue. I had no interest in it, wasn't going to pursue it, because I've got some challenges with it, so I just didn't pursue it. And it's nothing against anybody that does. I would say that I've been able to enjoy some opportunities and successes that maybe people who have with every letter and degree in every program have been unable to achieve, and vice versa. I'm sure it works both ways. What I've everything I've learned from budgeting to writing, the more administrative kinds of things, HR law, I've learned on the job, in the school of real life. And that doesn't mean that somebody who didn't learn it in real life doesn't have anything good to offer. There are things I wish I did better. I wish I wrote better. I don't write well. I wish I wrote better. So th there are things that I could have benefited from in education that I feel like I've more than made up for because of real life opportunity. But again, this is the important piece where I think the reasonable disagreement comes in. Had it not been for my situation during the era of 9/11, I would have never even had the opportunity. I would never make the cut along the way. So this will be the important piece that I'll end it on, because this is an important distinction, and this goes from the firefighter level all the way to the top. There is a very big, critical difference in formal education and intuitive education, right? I can read all the books, I can do the formal piece. And do everything I can do that way. The only way to be able to make good on those things that you learn, right? You've got to be able to go from theory and actually apply it in the real world and be successful not just try to apply it, but be applied and be successful. And without the experience, there is no way to make that transmission, right? Without experience, and this is the same as a firefighter, much of what we do as a firefighter and as a fire officer, including an incident commander, is intuitive decision making. It's the gut. It's the I've been here, I've seen this, my brain knows how to make sense of it. I can sort through these things very quickly because I don't have time to call Danny up and say, yo, Danny, what do you think about this row house fire, right? So as somebody who looks deeply into these line of duty death reports and these incidents that go bad, without the ability to have intuitive experience where what you know makes sense to you, there is a huge disconnect, and there will continue to be a huge disconnect. So I know I went around a big circle like that. You know, I'm not a super big guy on education, but it makes sense because I'm a guy that doesn't have it.
Right. No, I totally understand your point on it. I believe, to me, when you get to a certain level of rank within an organization, I think that's where, sometimes it does help. Like if you have a degree in management, where like fire chiefs, budgeting,
Sure.
personnel, line items,
Yeah.
dealing with mayors, town
Yeah.
councils, like. That's where
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's
Yeah.
the end all be all, but
Understood.
there's conversations out there where it's
Yeah.
like, well, this person doesn't have this. It doesn't mean that they're a bad person. I know
Right.
great leaders who don't have like
Amen.
a master's or whatever,
Amen.
but it
Amen.
doesn't mean that, you know what I mean? So I just wanted to
Yeah.
get your take on
Yep.
that.
Yep. Yep. Good stuff. Good stuff.
So a couple questions, personal questions I want to ask you because I believe it still goes on in DC today. So, with you being your retired chief of ops, my first question is, I think DC still utilizes inch and a half hose, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
And 3-inch cotton supply.
Three in supply line. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
You hear debates all the time, like
Yeah,
inch and a
sure.
half, and how
Sure.
come they don't have LDH?
Yeah.
So, just if I can just
Sure. Yeah,
pick your
sure.
brain on that,
Yeah, no, great.
is that a history thing, or does it actually work for you guys?
So look, remember, much of what goes on in any city fire department is historical. And I think there's a large piece of it that says this has worked for us until it doesn't. And when it doesn't, we need to change. Well, I can attest as one of, 50,000 DC firefighters over the time, who says that you could count on your hand, a single hand, the number of time that when it was appropriate, the inch and a half didn't work, like it failed us. There's certainly times where we pulled we stretched an inch and a half when we should have stretched it 2.5 inch, right? No question about that. But as far as performance, same thing with supply lines. There's a hydrant on every corner in the city, and then one in the middle of the block. Even though it's a very old system, it's largely reliable. So it's never, worst case scenario is you pulled up on a big job, you laid dual lines, so you had dual 3 inches. And that was successful for a long time, and it's successful today. The difference again, Danny, would be this, that why DC stuck with it, technology caught up with it, right? So now you're getting really, really close, gallon per minute flow out of an inch and a half as you are an inch and three quarter with the right nozzle, right couplings, and those type of things. So they stuck with it. It has worked for them. I am certain if and we suffered plenty of tragedy. And we needed to change things that we were way too slow to change at times. That was not one of them. And I remember this. We had an incident when I was new as the operations chief. We had a fire in a row house. It caught three guys up on the third floor, caught between the fire and their way out, and two of them were significantly burned in that incident. And I've always been one to go out and share. This is what happened. This is what I know. This is what we did well. This is what we got to do better and we got to fix. I would go out and do a presentation that had, really pretty noticeable failures at other levels. And you try to teach that to somebody, and the first thing they would say is, "Why would you run 500 feet of inch and a half?" "Because it works. I can show you, right? If you want to come out, we can show you the testing. We can do that. I've run 650 foot lines of inch and a half if you want. Is it the best for pump pressure all the time? No, of course it's got some limitations. But it has worked well. DC stuck with it because it worked for DC. Doesn't mean it works for every city. And then technology caught up with it, to where it's not that unusual. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't say this. If you are somebody, and I don't want to make this about the DC Fire Department. I also happen to be as from the time I was a kid, I was an FDNY buff. Spent so much time up there buffing. If I wanted to come back where I work now and implement New York City tactics, it would not be appropriate on any level, right? It would not work here. The building stock doesn't meet, the staffing doesn't meet, response times don't meet. So it worked, and it worked well for DC. It still does today. And to benefit that, technology caught up so that they're generally getting the same level of water flow out of their inch and a half as somebody else is out of their inch and three quarter.
Okay. All right. And unfortunately, with your experiences when you were chief of ops, you went through those hard times, a couple line of duty deaths. So I'm not trying to have you relive those, but my question to you for others to listen to is how, as an organization and as a person, firefighters should know signing up for this type of line of work. Injuries can happen, deaths can happen. We shouldn't let that prohibit us from actually, learning the job, learning how to do the job well. But in order to keep moving forward for anybody that for a chief or really anybody in administration that hasn't gone through that, what are the steps to allow yourself and your organization to move forward after dealing with something like that?
So the 3 or 4 critical line of duty deaths happened before I was the ops chief. I had a line of duty death, but it was a separate and apart from the ones that were notable for DC. So the first few, again, they happened. And it was like anything else. And look, the fire chief at the time, I can't say enough about this guy. I had worked with him as a captain. He was one of the finest men I ever worked with in my career. But he hadn't experienced that to that point. And so we had three very quickly, within 16 months. It was Sergeant John Carter who fell into the basement of a class five bodega from a unchecked basement fire, and then Tony Phillips and Lou Matthews on Cherry Road died in a townhouse, class five townhouse, it was I'll say that it wasn't unchecked, but by the time it was communicated, it was too late on a basement fire. And we had so many deficiencies in that department at the time. It was in the 90s. The government had just taken over because the city was bankrupt. And so the financial end of things were so horrible. We had broken rigs every day. We were running out. It was the worst possible scenario. These three guys died tragically, horribly, in their specific incidents. And reports were done, and the deficiencies were noted. They were everything you would imagine, right? Staffing, radios, poor training, this, that, and the other stuff. And really, for probably the next 4 or 5 years, almost nothing got done. And yes, let me say that. Is that the leader's responsibility to navigate the organization through something like that? It absolutely was. But as I said before, when I say the city was broke, it was broke. And even though three firefighters had just got killed, it didn't result in any money to fix anything. And I know that the gentleman who was the fire chief at the time, such a good gentleman, he was a fireman's fireman, and he loved his people. He was devastated and destroyed by what happened. And in spite of that, couldn't find a way to start incrementally moving us forward. When I became the ops chief, we had that near miss on 4th Street. Two of the guys were on ventilators for well over a week at a time. And I just had a new boss. Dennis Rubin became the fire chief in DC. And he said, after the incident settled, he came with so much experience. He had just finished a line of duty death in Atlanta, Georgia. And so he said to me, he said, "Chief, if you guys don't have a system for how to deal with this, let me help you walk through it." And of course, it was like, "Of course, you've been through this." Within 48 hours, we secured that property where the fire occurred, and we started bringing every company in the city through that row house and walked a minute by minute what we know happened. Based on radios, this is what we know happened. Every company, so that's four shifts, 17, 1,600 people a shift. We moved everybody through that property within 10 days. They walked away from the row house, and they went to a school next door where we did a program that reviewed basement procedures and the things that needed to be reviewed with that. I would say that the way that Dennis Rubin handled that, we avoided almost all the pitfalls that we had with Cherry Road and John Carter's death. No rumors, no bad blood, no finger pointing, none of that stuff, all of which we experienced for a long time during those first three. We didn't do it. So get out in front early, be completely honest and transparent. Get everybody out. Let them know what you know to that point. This is what we know to that point. And the best that you can, try to keep everybody involved along the way of what's going on.
Okay. Love that advice. Okay. So, currently now, you're the assistant chief of Anne Arundel. So my question to you is, as far as with your experience and everything that you've seen and that you've been through with your current organization now, how is the communications part as far as do you allow engines to do engine work, trucks do truck work? Like, how do your fire ground operations work?
So yeah, great point. I walked into kind of a unique opportunity here. Anne Arundel County was a very big county. It borders Baltimore City to the north. They're regular mutual aid partners of ours. And then on the east side, we push into Howard, Prince George's, right? Very big jurisdiction. And well populated, but the organization has largely been understaffed for years and years and years. I hate to say it, we still run with primarily three person companies. The chief and I have that has been what we've focused on for the past 7 years, along with other things, and we'll finish our time here focusing on four-person staffing, because unequivocally that's what the staffing needs to be on everything in here. And so it was a big county that was just viewed as small. A lot of engines when I got here still ran with two-person staffing. And again, I'm talking 600,000 person population, right? It's a big department, busy department. And the chief who was here before me had just started introducing SOGs. They were basically a command driven. Show up and wait for the chief to assume command and give you directions. And along the way, the department had really started to grow. A good, young, very ambitious, smart, into the job, love of the job, people. And obviously that type of system is going to be frustrating to them. All I've known are SOGs. We've had them in the district since I was a young firefighter. And they are the best practice. And I have enjoyed using my experience, not just in DC, but across the board. And what I have learned as a peer reviewer and a lead investigator for line of duty death reports, I've learned what I think is the sweet recipe. Look, Danny, all of the trainings, all of the research, right? We've had more research than a period of time ever before in the fire service. And the fire mapping study validates what has been known forever and ever, and that is the most effective way to save lives and reduce property is by quick application of water to the seat of the fire, most appropriately through interior stream, hose streams, right? Again, read my reports. When it's a defensive fire, we should be in the defensive posture. When it's not, we should find our way inside and deal with it that way. So I as one of the good things about being the operations chief is you do have, right? One of the few things you have kind of absolute authority on are the SOGs. And so I have was able to enhance what was started when I got here and spend the last 7 years embedding that in the officers and their decisions. So to get to your question, we operate off of SOGs until the strategic IC assumes command. That's the first battalion chief. Once first battalion chief does, that's it. They drive the incident based on their priorities. Engines do engine works, trucks do truck work. Rescue squad, we just include all of our trucks and rescues in a special service. So yeah, they each have their functional areas. Trucks and rescues do support work, engines do engine work, and that's how it rolls.
Okay. And this next question, it just in your personal opinion, with today's fire service, you have different groups and cadres and companies that'll come to organizations and be like, this is how you need to run the scene. Command from a car, mobile command, blue card, PDAs. And with your history, your knowledge, what is your go-to? What do you believe most organizations can work with that will be successful?
I'm gonna give you a super non-committal answer on this one. I've been fortunate to both teach on my own and teach for a pretty big long-standing one of the first, or probably certainly of the older of the training companies, and travel the United States to be able to teach. And honestly, when I was ye younger, I'm not young and I haven't been young for a long time. 15 years ago, Danny, I would be happy to go somewhere and say, this is my opinion. I think this is the best way to do that. And I do offer that. Again, if you were to read a line of duty death report, where I led a team to investigate that, I am very clear in how I think we should be doing things broadly. And then I got to a point really about 10 years ago, and honestly, where I would say I don't have a nickel in what other departments do. And I don't care, right? And I don't say that callously. I'm responsible for this jurisdiction and these people at this time. And that's what I need to focus my experience and my opinions and the people that I trust and that come in and help me with these decisions. I need to focus on them. I don't need to tell anybody else how to do their business no more than I would want somebody telling me how to do my business. So my style is command, and command's a good thing. I've not met anything. There's one rule I would say that I think applies across the board. There's no exception to it. It's the only black and white rule I can say. If you make a habit out of operating above an unchecked or unknown basement fire, you're gonna get hurt. Somebody is gonna get hurt at some point in time. As black as what you, we should not do that. That's as black and white as. After that, everything, every nozzle type, every hose stretch, every hose line, every command, where you're functioning command from, all of them have pluses and minuses. Right. So in a buggy, it's quiet. You can sit quietly. You can do everything you need to do there. It's important for you to be able to hear the radio. That works good in the car. The downside of being in the car is you lose a little bit of the environment, right? The weather, the things that the firefighters are going through. Sometimes at a paralysis, I'm one who says, if you can't see the back of the house, get out of the car and go look at the back of the house. Most other people would say paralyzed in that car, and something's going on that they can't even see and they don't even know about. Standing in the front yard gets you up close. You can see, you can smell, you can feel, you can walk around. A lot of benefit to that. Horribly distracted. It's tough to track units. It's tough to communicate. So what I do today when I'm asked for my opinion is I say, for everything you can tell me, right? I don't care what it is, ladders, right? Fly up or fly in, fly out. It doesn't matter. I'll give you an opinion, but it will be that everything has pluses and minuses, and you got to adapt it to your staffing, your structures, your building stock in your community, how you run things. Those are your decisions to make. So I am less of a black and white, this is the best way to do it, other than to say, here's the pluses and minuses of each of these things. God bless, go figure it out.
Okay. But one thing for sure, though. Basement fires. You got to make sure. So, and in order for, and this is my personal opinion, in order to do that, 360s must get completed.
There's no, now, of course, if you if the building is large and you can't get around it, or there's no rear entrances, right? You can't tell anything. Then even if you're going to go through the front door as the last resort, before you do anything else, you still got to open the basement door and clear it, right? So yes, that's a golden rule. But I also know there's a lot of places, a lot of communities that largely don't have basements, right? So
Correct. Correct.
even that's general.
Okay. All right. Another personal opinion question. What does the term aggressive, as in aggressive firefighting or firefighter, mean to you?
It's another thing that I will unabashedly not shy away from. Aggressive means to be exactly what it says, right? To move forward, to move with urgency, to work in towards, to move into. And I've said the majority of fires in the United States, and this is a general statement, so it's important to clarify this. If you're showing up with one or two people on a rig, all everything I say is generally out the window. I'm not speaking to that situation. Even with three people on a rig and 15 minutes between the next engine arriving, how aggressive can you be? So if but you and I are not going to play word games with this. Let's make a basic assumption that every rig is staffed with three, and I know this is a dumb assumption to make. This is a big fire service, but for the sake of giving you an answer, that I don't have to then say, well, I didn't mean that.
Right.
Three people on a rig, within the 7-10 minute time frame, you have the right number, 15, 20 people on a box alarm to assemble a structure fire. Most of the situations are offensive that require us to quickly use it aggressively, fastly, with urgency, swiftly, whatever word you want to use, to get inside and apply water to the seat of the fire. Under the auspice of if you got the right amount of resources, you got the right people, you got water, and the structure is sound, then we should be aggressively trying to get in there and do that, unless it's the situations dictate otherwise. So it's gosh, 42 years, there's a million things. To get into debate somebody about aggressive. Well, I think we ought to be aggressive and smart. Well, I think we ought to be old and healthy, right? So of
Right.
course all those things go into it, but we shouldn't walk away from that term. Or look, I tell you, here's a side note, and this is something a little bit different, but I want to make the comparison. When I'm not working, I'm somebody who lives in the community, right? I'm a resident that pays my taxes. I pay for the public safety services, and I want them to perform. I have a young granddaughter with special needs. She spends a lot of time going from the house to the hospital. Our medics come. I want them to come quickly. I want them to be super, super proficient at their job. I want them to be aggressive at the protocol treatments that they want me to do. As a citizen in your community, that's what they all want, right? Everybody that pays taxes in your community, I don't care where you live, they want you to show up quickly. They want you to be proficient at your job, and they want you to have a level of empathy for them when you call. Trying to talk to them about, well, we're trying to change this aggressive culture. The aggressive culture is not the is not the match that's lighting the fire, causing the whole house to come down, right? It may be a single factor in a group of factors, and yes, we do need to be smart. We need to do all those things, but we need to be aggressive too. Whether we're doing fire EMS, we need to approach each of our calls aggressively.
Love it. Love it. Now, your department's not the only one, I'm sure, in the entire United States that's going through this, but you mentioned it, three person staffing. I've always heard the adage, firefighters, we make do with what we have. We do more with less.
Yep.
In order to change that narrative, the example, if I'm a city council member and you come to me and you're like, hey, we'd love to up our staffing on each apparatus to four. I understand the biggest hiccup with anything in today's economy, money drives everything.
Does.
But with departments that are doing what they have to do with three-person staffing, if you come to me and I'm city council and I go, well, you guys are already doing it with what you got. Why do you need, how do organizations and chief officers combat that?
Yeah, no, I look this I always say here, I will leave here at some point in time, and my takeaway from this department will be the ingenuity, the braveness, the passion, the commitment that these folks have is unbelievable, because these are the people here who have largely for years, not just in recent time, have done more with less. and have never wanted to be told you gotta do less, right? You gotta slow down. You gotta make the calls here. They didn't want to hear that. They don't want to hear it now, right? We move to be able to become SOG driven, move aggressively, move with urgency, move with confidence, and to do those things. And so we could be in that very situation, right? Our elected officials in this county would say that probably above any other agency, they hear the most positive things about the fire department in this jurisdiction. And again, that there's probably the same thing in a lot of jurisdictions. But A, being honest, A about saying you have highly dedicated employees who are pushing themselves into unsafe territory just to get the job done, right? And you're seeing the results of it. What you're not seeing is how they're being stretched to the limit, physically, mentally, and everything else, to try to get that done. The second piece is the reality. It's been luck, right? Nothing as bad has happened just by luck and chance, because every time they go somewhere, they're set up in a situation where they could get stretched too thin, overcommitted, and something catastrophic happens. I think the good thing, Danny, I would say, is the fire chief now with the studies from the IAFF that the IAFF did, and that program out of Fairfax, Virginia, where it was UL with Fairfax, all the metropolitan fire departments in the region, along with the IAFF. They ran those high-rise procedures with three, four, and five, and six-person engine companies, and just tons of documentation and data that prove unequivocally that the four-person staffing is they perform higher. They're able to get search and rescue completed quicker, lines in place, prevent damage quicker. So there's more data out there now. At the same time, I don't know. I think if everybody looked where they live, and this is what makes being a politician so unattractive. Everybody has a lot of needs. We have needs in the fire department here without question. The schools have needs. There's social services. I mean, the social services that can't get met here end up on our laps anyway, right? So everybody has needs. Staffing is expensive. Heavy is the head that wears the crown, and that's the burden that's on the politicians to be. And it's our job to present the data. It's our job not to sugarcoat it and say, here's the information. And then you have to make that decision. And then as executive officers, we decide whether we have a palate to continue on with it. None of us are forced to be in our position. Nobody holds a gun to our head and says you have to stay there if it becomes such a disdain and a concern. Well, then you have options. You can stay and fight it out, or you can say, I can't be part of, I can't be part of this.
When it comes to recruitment and retention, where do you see the fire service doing good on, and where do you see areas where we can improve on? Because you mentioned it back when you were trying to get on, I'm assuming in the 80s, very competitive, thousands and thousands of applicants. Now these same departments are seeing, instead of thousand, a few hundred. And then we all know half of those will be dismissed during the process of trying to get hired. So where are a couple of things, or where's one thing you can see we can do better on to get more people into the job?
I think it's supply and demand at this point is the issue. There is more supply and or more demand and not enough supply across the board. Remember, so I live in that area of Maryland where you have, right, coming right on down the line, Baltimore City, Baltimore County, Howard County, Anne Arundel, Prince George's, Washington, D.C., Fairfax. the number of career departments out here is unbelievable. And a lot of them are big departments and they're hiring every year. They can never get enough applicants to fill a class. So there, the one part is this supply and demand. The second piece is I think every organization is trying to do better and become more attractive to people in hopes, right? So what the one strategy is to give the test, but I think that some are relying on making your place so attractive that everybody leaves other places to come to you, which then makes everybody else try to become more attractive and things start to get out of whack, right? And I think you can see that happening now. So I don't have a real answer. The volunteer component of the National Fire Service is going to continue to struggle. It's going to cause jurisdictions to hire more career people, and we're going to continue to struggle to get the candidates. Life and generation is different. I don't want to make this necessarily a generational issue, but it is different. So I think making sure that the testing processes are appropriate, right? If we're given mathematics, writing, engineering, if we're applying a bunch of white collar testing to a blue collar profession, we're not going to get the right people. You could get really smart people. It doesn't mean you're going to get the right people. So I think making that, I still think CPAT, getting something that can be looked at and say, yes, this is relevant to the fire service. It's legally sufficient, and sticking with those so that we don't have all types of one-offs hanging all over the place is an important piece. But big issue that I don't have a lot of answers to.
No,
I would say make sure our organization is on. If our organization is doing the right things, if we're treating people good in the fire, if the leadership is treating people good. If the leadership is trying to provide people with what they need in the station, and leadership and officers and unions are working together to create good environments in the stations, then you won't bleed people, right? Retainment comes issue. Got to pay them right, good schedule, all that type of stuff. But if you got a bunch of crap birds, nobody's going to work. Want to work there, even if you get them through the door, they won't work there long.
And the white collar testing for a blue collar profession, that to me, that and that's where, we have to find that fine balance between the education and experience piece. But this job is still, if you're
Yes.
on
Yeah.
a
It's
truck,
vocation.
if you're on the front line, this is a blue collar
Yeah.
job.
Yeah, you're a contractor, right? You're a carpenter, you're a welder, you're all that.
That's a fact. Okay. All right. Wellness and truly being there for one another, like I said earlier, through your experiences, and this is why I love talking to individuals that have they've seen the progression of the fire service, has how it's evolved. What's your take on, like, we all love the job side where we're able to talk to people and they can tell you stories and we can learn from this and that and the other. But when it comes to actually being there, that brotherhood we talk about, what does that mean to you?
So again, if I'm being honest, and people say, well, what's changed over the years? And I think there's a lot of things behind it. So when I went to work in DC, going to a deck party, right? They would call it a deck party. Somebody in the house is building a deck, and it's like a party. Well, come over, we're gonna have a party and build a deck. There wasn't much party. It was all work, and showing up wasn't optional, right? And I remember as a young guy, I got on the job. I was married and I had little kids, and on my days off, you're going over to a buddy's house to help build a deck, or to run somebody so they can drop their car off at someone and drive them out to Virginia to get to their house, or dragging my wife along to a wedding where she knows doesn't know any. Those things were not optional, right? The officers purposefully and intently built family within the company, and like anything else, not allowing the kids to opt out, that was an option. You had to show up, and if you didn't show up, you would know about it, and they would very they would very much let you know the difference between selfishness and selflessness. And when you can build that environment, and when you become somebody who's just selfless, I can just go through so many experiences of somebody in need, doesn't even work in your company or your battalion, but they say, "Hey, tomorrow you guys got to go get some stuff for the gift bag, right? Just hit the local liquor stores, let them know who you're with, show them your IFF, card, wear your shirt, try go out and get something. You don't even know who this person is, but you did that, right? People from every battalion went out, they did things, and they contributed to that." So building a family, there is sacrifice, right? You do give up time with your personal family. You do give up a lot to be able to do that. But there's two things about family. I don't know your family. My guess is if somebody picks on Danny, they got a whole lot of people who are lined up to take care of business, right? Your brothers, sisters, cousins, uncles. They got your back, and they don't worry about nothing, and they're not double think, well, should we get involved in this? If they mess with Danny, they get the force of what comes from your family. We while it doesn't happen a lot, we could easily find ourselves in a situation where you're working with somebody who has to make a decision. Do I stay and get Danny out of this hole, or do I risk burning up to death myself? And I can either make a left and go to Danny, or make a right and go out a window. There are plenty of times in the fire service where I'm sure people made a right out the window, right? When they don't know the person who's there, they don't like the person who's in trouble. And when, again, we say, oh, this would never happen. When a human being is in a position where it's life or death, I do this, right? Our warriors face this every single day. What is it that makes them stay and sacrifice their own life? It's not just because they have the same shield on their helmet. Again, two guys in a company that piss all over each other, can't stand each other. I wonder how that's going to work out. Family? Camarade, I mean, that level of family, it doesn't become a question, right? Again, we see that, we have seen that through time with our warriors in the military who don't make a right when making a left is the right decision there. So, but that's the company officer's job, is to build that within a unit. What pulls against that? I do think the 24/72 schedule, right? That's what we work generally out here in this way. People have moved farther away from work for affordability and quality of life. There's less bowling leagues, there's less softball, there's less activities that bring people back. Look at a union meeting. I don't care where you are. I said I was a involved with the union heavily in DC during my time as a firefighter there. And if it was a contract or something big, you'd have a packed house on most days. You couldn't get 15 people in the room. So it's a bigger issue where people do their job, right? They say they want more quality of life. They do their job and they go home. So I think the challenge for the officer is, how do I build that environment here without putting a ton of demands? And some of it is going to be self-sacrifice. Some of it is going to be selflessness. But four or five, three people in a station, 24 hours together, you get a lot of time at the table to keep it real with each other, right? For the officer to facilitate, this is a place where we keep it real. We don't unnecessarily stab at anybody. We don't leave anybody out, because if we can't function and communicate and cooperate as a group of three, we will never do that on the firehouse. And let me end with that point. Everything that we do as an operations chief, you as a company officer, everything is about the performance of your crew. Every single thing, every day boils down to performance. And who are the companies that perform the best? I challenge you to go to your next job, look at a company that performs amazingly on the fireground. And if you were to follow them back to the firehouse, and they never knew you were there, you were just a fly on the wall, I would bet you would see that environment being created in that station. And when you find a bunch of goofballs and you followed them back to the station, you would find the exact opposite of that. That's why the officer's responsible to build that level of family within that company.
Preach, preach, chief. Absolutely. Okay. My last question I like to always ask the guests, where would you like to see yourself before you decide to finally hang it all up?
I'm working through that as we speak. Again, it's been 42 years. I'm 64 years old. The fire department is the only thing I knew. The only job, I had two jobs before this. One was on an ambulance at the Thoroughbred racetrack. And during the off season, I mucked horse stalls. And the other job was I worked at a landfill. I told you I quit school in the ninth grade. I did work on a tobacco farm for a year. But then I moved up and went to the dump to pick up trash along the side of the road. But other than that, this is what I know. So I feel like if I decide to wind it down, I think I said it's at the beginning of your program, the fire service owes me nothing, not a plaque, not a thank you. I owe it everything. So I don't know. That's going to be a tough transition for me. I've tried it twice already and failed at it. I feel like it's going to stick only because at 64, it starts to, you do have a few setbacks here and there. But no, I do say this. Gosh, this is going to come off horrible. I'm not pinning anybody for this. Nobody should ever take this as a pin. There are some amazing advocates in the fire service who have been retired, and they give again, one of my favorites, John Salka, is one of my favorite. I hope he never walks away from the fire service. The man has got so much in his stories that young firefighters need to hear. What I don't want the fire service to become is led by people who don't do the job anymore, and that includes myself. To this point, I've been able to say I've done this job since I was 20 years old. I'm 64. So when that time comes, I do want to say, let you know, don't be what you didn't want to be, which was somebody who just hangs around too long.
No, I 100% understand that statement, 100%. And that's that humility right there, because you can have an individual who's still involved. They're involved, but they haven't been quote unquote involved with the latest and greatest. And they're there, and they don't see themselves as a hindrance. But I understand completely what you're saying.
Yeah, the fire service moves quick, buddy. The younger generations are smarter, technology's quicker, strategies and tactics, why most of them have been time tested and proven. There's no way to walk away from so many good tactics we have. The fire service moves quickly, and you don't have to be out of it long to be out of it.
If I before we depart, if I
Sure.
can ask one last question, what is one thing back when you started and what you're seeing today that has just either mind blown, or you're just like, we're still doing this in the fire service. One thing that comes to mind.
I think I would have to say being selfless. Right. Again, if in my probation, I remember complaining one time about having to take a detail. And I'm not kidding you. I never forgot what was told, how the crew reacted to me at trying to sharpshoot and get out of something that somebody else was inevitably going to have to get into. Being on this job requires you to be a selfless person, regardless what level of the organization you're at, and not doing what's best for you, but looking at your crew and or your people in the organization and saying, this is I'm gonna put it's not like I'm gonna look at myself as lowly. I need to put their needs ahead of my needs, right? That's what this job is largely about. That's what's made it amazing. So that would be the one. And I think largely in the last 20 years, it has largely become a lot of focus on what's best for self.
Okay. I know I said this
I
before.
apologize to all the selfless people out there because there really are a lot of selfless people still in the service.
Yes, for sure. This was honestly, this would be my last final
All good.
question.
It's all good, buddy.
With your with your career, with your entire career, has fire chief never come up, or is that something you were like, that's just not me?
Wasn't that I didn't try. I well, most of the time, even today, I will not meet minimum qualifications
Gotcha.
if it asks for something. But for I always say God is the forefront of everything for me, has had it in my life plan to be the bridesmaid, and buddy, if there's nothing wrong with that, that has been an amazing opportunity because I have always loved the firefighting side of this business, so he knows what's best for me, and I'm sure. Knows more than I do that where my joy and happiness is in this realm of the thing, but I largely would not qualify for a lot of places because I don't have the educational requirements.
Gotcha.
Yep.
Okay. All right. With that being said, Chief, I just want to say thank you for taking time out of your day to do this.
And you kidding me? What a blessing. Thank you.
I know we met back in Greensboro at training
Yes, sir.
days. Phenomenal class that you did with
Ricky.
Chief Ricky Riley. I appreciate both of you. I appreciate you. I appreciate your sentiment, your mindset, the message that you preached on that day of lecture. I just want to say, continue to be you. I have no doubt that you will continue to do so. And Chief, I just seriously have to say thank you for coming on and talking shop.
And thank you, Danny. Thank you for having me. It was great to meet you out there and to find somebody again. Humility is such a gift in a bunch of different things, but to have a gentleman who has a podcast about something that you love, and it's easy to tell how much you love this, and yet you bring guests after guests after guests on and never use the platform to talk about yourself or what you believe. Obviously, to be a host, you've got to be able to share some of those things. But the true human is to be able to say, I want to hear, I want to absorb, I want to learn, I want to listen. That is some medicine that we could all do more of. So kudos to you. I've been going back listening to your stuff. All of them are great. But again, when you're passionate, there's just this want you want to talk about the things you're passionate and you do your listeners and your watchers a great service by not you never make the show about yourself. You always make it about the guests. So that's why you're successful at what you do.
I appreciate that, Chief. Thank you very much for that.
Got it. You got it, buddy.
Sir, have a great day, sir.
You as well.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.